Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Armand Yildiz, and I'm a PhD candidate at the Department of Anthropology at Harvard. And this is the first ever podcast episode I'm hosting. I recently became a podcast host for the Anthropology channel of the New Books Network and have the great honor of hosting Katharina Galore and Syed Atshan for their wonderful book, The Moral Triangle, Germans, Israelis, Palestinians, published in 2020 by Duke University Press. And before we start our conversation, which I'm looking forward to, let me introduce Kati and Said. Katharina Galore is an art historian and archaeologist specializing in the visual and material culture of Israel-Palestine. She is currently the Hirschfeld Senior Lecturer in Judaic Studies at Brown University. She has also taught at the Hebrew University, the École Biblique et Archéologique Française in Jerusalem, at Tufts University and Rhode Island School of Design in the US, and most recently at Humboldt University in Berlin. Her publications include The Archaeology of Jerusalem, From the Origins to the Ottomans, co-authored with Hans-Wolf Blödhorn, which came out in 2013 from Yale University Press, and Finding Jerusalem, Archaeology Between Science and Ideology, that was published in 2017 by the University of California Press. She is currently at work on Jewish Women, Portraits of Conformity and Agency, a project supported by a grant from the Leo Baeck Institute Berlin. Syed Atshan is an acting associate professor of anthropology at Emory University and associate professor of peace and conflict studies at Swarthmore College. He previously served as a postdoctoral fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. He earned a joint PhD in anthropology and Middle Eastern studies and an MA in social anthropology from Harvard University and a master's in public policy degree from the Kennedy School, Harvard. He received his BA from Swarthmore College in 2006. Around the same time as The Moral Triangle, his book Queer Palestine and The Empire of Critique came out from Stanford University Press in 2020, and the book received the Ruth Benedict Prize of the Association for Queer Anthropology. He has been awarded multiple grants and fellowships, including from the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, Open Society Foundations, National Science Foundation, Social Sciences Research Council, Woodrow Wilson National Foundation, Andrew Mellon Foundation, and the Jack Kent Cook Foundation. He is the recipient of a Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship and Catherine Davis Fellowship for Peace. He is a Palestinian Quaker and LGBTQ human rights activist. I'm honored to be hosting such brilliant scholars on the podcast, and I must say The Moral Triangle is a very special book for me, not only because it's the first book I chose to do a podcast about, but also because I live in Berlin at the moment, and the stories and the tensions coming out of the book are very familiar and tangible once you live in Berlin and hang out in these circles. So it's wonderful to have you here, Kati and Syed, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Amon, for having us. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about our book. And thank you so much for this very warm introduction.
Absolutely. As Kati mentioned, we're so grateful. Thank you so much for hosting us. It's a real honor.
It's my pleasure. I'd like to jumpstart our conversation with the question. I was wondering, how did you meet each other and how did you come to write this book together?
Shall I tell the story, Syed? So it was love at first sight. No. So this was actually in 2014 during the Gaza war. I had just returned from Jerusalem, returning to Brown, and Saed was at Brown at the time as a postdoctoral fellow at the Watson Institute, and the Center for Middle East Studies organized a panel on the Gaza war, the consequences of the Gaza war, and I attended this panel, and Saed was really standing out from a group of senior scholars, all much more senior than him, but he was, to me at least, the star of this panel, and I walked up to him once the discussions were over and introduced myself, and we spoke briefly, and then coincidentally, a week later, a Jewish friend of Saed and a Palestinian friend of mine, who were also friends, decided that the two of us had absolutely to get to know each other, and they organized a little tea get-together, and this is when we really first started to have a serious discussion, and I think over time became very, very fond of each other, very interested in each other's work, even though we come from very different disciplinary backgrounds. I think what we have in common is the interest in Israel-Palestine. And so we started to read each other's work, but it was not until I came to Berlin in 2016 for a couple of years when I had this idea to work on something together.
Anything you'd like to add, Syed?
No, Kati said it really well. I mean, I'm so grateful for our friendship and our partnership and intellectual collaborations. And we're very, very proud of the book. And we're so honored that, Amanji, you were able to read it. And we very much look forward to the discussion.
And then you decided that you'd like to work on something together, but how did the idea of what to do and how to do it came about?
So I discovered that there was a huge Israeli community in Berlin, which I was very intrigued by this phenomenon. The media was really full of this. I mean, in Israel, there was a lot of media coverage on this phenomenon, also to some extent in Germany and internationally. It's really a phenomenon. Why of all places would Israelis pick Berlin to settle, to migrate to? And then after a while, I also found out about the even larger Palestinian community that lives in Berlin. And I shared this with Saed. And so we thought this would be an opportunity for a short paper. And then once I convinced Saed, it didn't take long for us to get started to do the research. And then ultimately Saed came to Berlin to do extensive field study. And it very quickly exploded into a book-length manuscript.
And a wonderful one, didn't that? And how did you come up with the title, Moral Triangle, and how does it capture your project?
So the main question we ask is, what is the moral responsibility that Germany, both state and society, have towards Israelis and Palestinians in their borders as well as in Israel-Palestine? And so this question of moral responsibility is an anthropological question. It's also a philosophical question. And it's inspired by the work of Noam Chomsky and his book, The Fateful Triangle, where he thinks about the role of the United States vis-a-vis Israel-Palestine and the triangle that connects Americans, Israelis, and Palestinians. And so as a result, we realized that there wasn't enough work on Germany, given the very important and powerful role that Germany plays. And so it's a twist on the fateful triangle that we use, the moral triangle, given our central concern regarding moral responsibility.
For the listeners who may not be aware, can you also maybe talk about the triangle itself, like how and why Berlin came to be the space for this triangle to be this visible?
So this triangle connects Germans, Israelis, and Palestinians. Edward Said, the late Palestinian intellectual, once said that Palestinians are the victims of the victims, the refugees of the refugees. And so trauma and moral responsibility and political violence and state intervention, all of these issues really connect Germans, Israelis, and Palestinians on a visceral level for over seven decades now. But Berlin is a central site for that triangle to manifest. It's a central site for Germans, Israelis, and Palestinians to have really meaningful interactions and spaces of both solidarity and anti-solidarity. So in our book, we provide an ethnographic account of that triangle and how it connects the social fabric of everyday lives of Germans, Israelis, and Palestinians in Berlin.
And maybe as a side question, I mean, during my fieldwork, a lot of people told me that Berlin is not Germany. It's much more different. It doesn't compare to the rest of the Germany. Did that also come up in your conversations, or how did it affect your project looking at Germany from the lens of Berlin?
Yeah, so Berlin is really a very unique case, and we make it very clear that our focus is exclusively on the city. And I mean, first of all, for the reasons that you just mentioned, Berlin is not Germany. Berlin is very different from the rest of Germany, but it also has this very special role in the context of the Holocaust. So in terms of today's memory culture, and not only the memory, but also the physical reminders all throughout the city of what happened during the Holocaust, during the Second World War. And so therefore, obviously, Berlin is a very unique city in terms of its Vergangenheitsbewältigung and also rather successful tourism industry that plays out in a very tangible way. But the other reasons why it is so unique is because Berlin attracts such a large group of Palestinians and such a large community of Israelis for very different reasons and with very unique histories. But the coming together of these three communities in this relatively small space, in this, well, it's not such a small space, but in this one city is really a very unique case study and a very unique opportunity to engage these three communities between past events and the current situation of migration within Berlin, but also with regard to Germany's relationship with Israel-Palestine.
And I mean, for the listeners who may not be aware, I mean, maybe a step back. At the beginning of the book and throughout the book, actually, you point at some occasions in which anti-Semitism and Zionism are conflated. And for the listeners who may not be aware, can you tell a bit more about this conflation of Zionism and anti-Semitism in Germany, or in general, I would say? And to me, this conflation usually works together with being very careful of not conflating between racism and anti-Semitism, or there are usually strong arguments against such conflations. How did you see in your research process this interplay of keeping anti-Semitism very spacious, but very special at the same time?
You know, Katia and I really are deeply committed to resisting anti-Semitism. Katia comes from a Jewish German Israeli background. Her family, you know, 90% of her family perished in the Holocaust, and her father survived. Auschwitz. And for me, it's been really powerful through our friendship to learn about Kati and her family's history and their trauma and their struggles, and also Kati's growing up in Germany and the anti-Semitism that she faced. And so we are very much committed to resisting all forms of oppression, including anti-Semitism. And surely anti-Semitism is a form of racism. In contemporary Germany, we argue that you can't understand one form of racism without looking at how it intersects with all forms of racism, including anti-Arab racism, Islamophobia, because often the same forces, these white nationalists, Germans, you know, neo-Nazis, etc., they share an underlying hostility towards any form of difference. And that xenophobia continues to manifest, and that needs to be resisted as well. Unfortunately, on the official level, the German public discourse and the German state often conflate resistance to Israeli oppression and criticism of the Israeli state or Zionism with anti-Semitism. Now, sometimes there is an overlap. Sometimes anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism do overlap, but that's the exception and not the rule. It is possible to be both committed to resistance against anti-Semitism and critical of the Israeli state and its racism and its violence and its oppression. But in contemporary Germany, there's a knee-jerk response. Anytime you critique the Israeli state or Zionism, you're met with this response or suspicion that you're anti-Semitic. And given Germany's special relationship with Israel, that makes it very difficult, especially for the Palestinian community in Berlin, to be able to express their identity and to express their experience and to have space in the public discourse.
Yeah, if I may add to this, that we very much felt that there was a clear relationship between the public official discourse of conflating Israel criticism with anti-Semitism. This was very much an attitude that was shared by most of the Germans we interviewed and we encountered in informal and less formal contexts. But what we felt was almost like an irony is that there is this enthusiasm that thanks to the Israeli migration, there is a revival of Jewish life in Berlin, and Germans are very proud about this. I mean, most Germans and really embrace this Israeli community in their city. On the other hand, the majority of this Israeli migrant community tends to be left-wing and critical of Israel. And here, suddenly, these Israelis are being judged by Germans who perceive them as anti-Semitic. And that was something that a lot of interlocutors shared with us. They found it very disturbing that of all people, it is Germans who criticize them for being anti-Semitic because they are critical of their government. And while being very committed Jews and feeling very comfortable with their religious and ethnic background.
I mean, this is already a huge topic in itself. And yeah, I can continue asking questions about this for hours. But to follow up on that, how did the then interplay between anti-Semitism and Islamophobia or anti-Muslim racism came out in your field research? I'm curious in what ways your interlocutors talked about it, because what is one of the things that this book brilliantly does is to show these things, as you said, Said, like these things are perpetrated by similar groups, usually in Germany. So how did that came up in your research?
Well, you know, we didn't shy away from being very honest and being very transparent with our interlocutors about our own positionality and backgrounds. They were aware that Kati is Israeli. They were aware that I'm Palestinian. And we also didn't curate what we found as a result of our interviews and ethnography. So in the book, as I'm sure you're familiar and you saw, we actually narrate examples where people were quite overt in their sentiments that were quite racist, whether anti-Semitic or, you know, anti-Arab racism or anti-Palestinian racism. And so we actually reference different anecdotes in which an individual expressed anti-Semitism very overtly, or a person expressed, for instance, Islamophobia very overtly. But I think what was really important was that we withheld judgment and we remained patient, we remained gracious, we supported one another during these very, very difficult moments. And we also kept our eye on the prize that actually, in the end, this will make our ethnography and ultimately our book even more rich and even more compelling when we're able to really bring these issues to the forefront in a very honest and nuanced manner. And that nuance was also something we were striving towards in the book.
Yeah, they're bringing anti-Semitism and Islamophobia into dialogue is something that is very complicated. And I think a lot of scholars but also the public tends to be very nervous when these phenomena are discussed in dialogue. And we're not claiming that they have identical histories and identical expressions and encounters in Berlin or Germany more broadly. We do differentiate between the very unique expressions of anti-Semitism and the very unique expressions of Islamophobia. But we also try to resist to claim that these are phenomenon of racism that have no overlaps and parallels. So we found it very important to bring these different phenomena into dialogue.
And I mean, to go more deep into the book, in the first chapter, Trauma, Holocaust, Nakba, you refer to Michael Rothberg to talk about moral privileges that may come with trauma. And then in the chapter, you show how your interlocutors see care and compassion as limited goods that should be earmarked for things that are closer to themselves. Like Martin, a Jewish German, saying, and I'm quoting, "I know I should feel bad for Palestinians, but my heart is filled with the trauma of my own people." Would you like to elaborate on that point a little bit? Because I think it's fascinating that care and compassion in your interviews then came out as this limited capital or limited good.
Well, we're very much inspired by the work of Michael Rothberg, who's a professor of Holocaust studies at UCLA and a really prolific and brilliant scholar. And his theory of multidirectional memory is one that we open the book with and we close the book with, and really is at the heart of what we're doing in terms of our theorization. So Michael Rothberg delineates his notion of multidirectional memory, and he juxtaposes it with the idea of competitive memory. So competitive memory is a situation in which we feel that acknowledging another people's struggle or suffering or trauma in the public domain or private domain will necessarily take away from the acknowledgement of our own struggle or our own positionality or our own claim to memory, and therefore may take away from compassion being extended towards us. But he argues, in fact, that's not true. In fact, the more space we create for more acknowledgement of trauma and of suffering and of social struggles for all oppressed communities, both historically and in the present, the more space that there will be for all of us, ultimately. So that generosity of spirit, of multidirectional memory, is one that we try to embody in our partnership, in our research collaboration, in the book that we produce, as well as in the voices of a number of our interlocutors who share that commitment to extending compassion from Germany towards Israelis and Palestinians as well. But unfortunately, not everyone shares that commitment and not everyone has that generosity of spirit.
And then you also intervene with this generic understanding of victims and perpetrators. So you complicate it in the books. Would you like to talk more about this?
Yeah, so the general tendency is to identify Germans as the perpetrators, and at least in the German context, it is usually the Jews, which is then extrapolated to include the Israelis as the victims. But very quickly, we obviously realized as we interviewed our different community members that they're very different views, and that the situation is much more complex. Germans can sometimes be victims. Israelis can be victims, but they can, for many, they are the perpetrators, and vice versa. For some, Palestinians are the perpetrators. For others, they are the victims. And we also understood that sometimes one individual or one community can have certain aspects of a victim and a perpetrator at the same time. So we try to break a little bit these stereotypical categorizations of associating one community as a monolithic entity with either victimhood or being perpetrators.
And then do you find the terms victim and perpetrator useful analytic categories in general?
Well, we actually try to question the validity of these terms, and some of our interlocutors were actually not so happy because it as if reinforces certain stereotypes. But we decided to use these terms because the literature that deals with these communities uses these terms repeatedly.
And I mean, maybe it's a difficult question, and of course we don't maybe have the time to parse out details, but I was very interested in this idea of restorative justice that you discuss in the Moral Triangle chapter. Could you talk a bit more about that? And maybe another question then would be, how do you envision a restorative justice that includes Germans, Israelis, and Palestinians?
You know, often restorative justice is juxtaposed with the idea of retributive justice, you know, and especially in the US context, we're so used to the legal system and system of accountability being so punitive, such an emphasis on retribution. But restorative justice is meant to be much more broad. It's supposed to include the social ecosystem. It's supposed to be victim focused. It's supposed to include everyone. And it's supposed to focus not just on accountability, but also ultimately healing on an individual and on a collective level. And so one of our main findings in the book is that as we look at this moral triangle, we see that on the German-Israeli side of the triangle, there are all of these efforts towards restorative justice, and those are incredibly inspiring. Also on the Israeli-Palestinian side of the triangle, there are also tremendous efforts in Berlin today, in the present, towards restorative justice. But it's actually the German-Palestinian side of the triangle where we see a dearth of efforts towards restorative justice. Some are in the private sphere, the civil society sphere, but they have a long way to go in terms of acknowledgement, recognition, in terms of translating to the public sphere or into policy or really into meaningful practice. And so what we hope is that we will see more efforts towards restorative justice between Germans and Palestinians as well. And as Germany embraces more of a democratic model, right, if it truly lives into its democracy and truly listens to the voices of its diverse population, of its own grassroots movements and civil society forces, it will see that more and more young Germans and other Germans are calling for a different kind of engagement with the question of Palestine and with the Palestinian population in Germany's borders in the present. So we hope that German policymakers and state officials will open their hearts more to this discourse.
And did you come across any good examples of restorative justice attempts at restorative justice between Germans and Palestinians while you were in Germany?
Yeah, I do think that there are some efforts on the part of the German political establishment. I mean, there are a lot of foundations that establish headquarters in the Palestinian territories in the West Bank and in Gaza. There's a lot of effort invested in humanitarian aid. So there's definitely that on the official side. And we felt that there was even more interest in civil society at grassroots level. There are a lot of Germans who are actually critical of their government for often censoring Palestinian populations in Germany and Berlin more specifically. And so we felt that a lot of individuals and organizations of Germans are actually much more understanding of the plight that the Palestinians have suffered and continue to suffer.
And I mean, another question that came to mind, and of course you also mentioned this in the book, there are multiple affiliations of the people you interviewed besides being German, Israeli, or Palestine. And one axis of it is definitely sexuality. And I am also, that's the topic I'm working on as well. I wanted to dive in. For instance, I mean, I was at the 2016 Christopher Street Day March, which is the name of the main Pride March in Berlin. And I saw how Palestinian and pro-Palestinian activists were violently silenced when they were protesting the pinkwashing of Israel at the event. And what was very striking to me that it was the other queer people marching alongside them who started hitting the activists with their handheld rally sticks, which carried banners calling for love and equality. And a couple of years ago, and you mentioned this in the book as well, in an alternative Pride March called the Radical Queer March, the organizers called the police against the participation of the Palestinian bloc, which actually gave birth to the formation of an amazing activist group called Queers Against Racism and Colonialism, and a separate Pride March organized by them. So in the midst of all these peculiarities and tensions, I'd like to also hear more about how your interlocutors talked about the effects of homonationalism and pinkwashing in Germany. And for those of you who are not familiar, homonationalism is a term coined by Jasbir Puar, and it refers to the deployment of LGBTQI rights discourse for racist ends, to say the least. And in the context of Palestine-Israel, pinkwashing is a term activists and academics use more often. And Syed, you wrote a whole book about this, so I will leave the intricacies of it to you. How do you think these tensions play out in Germany?
Well, you know, Katia and I are very committed to gender and sexuality studies as well. This is one of our passions. Katia's working on an exciting new book. I just recently finished reading a draft of the manuscript on Jewish women that covers an incredible array of time and looks at the role of women in Jewish society. And I'm also, you know, a feminist, a queer activist. And so during our fieldwork, these issues of this triangle, Germans, Israelis, Palestinians, and how it intersects with questions of gender and sexuality really did come up in really salient ways. It doesn't end up becoming the major thrust or theme of our book. It actually warrants its own book, to be honest. There's enough material and enough fascinating issues, as you just alluded to, Armand, that could become its own book. So for example, Hila Amit is someone that we met during our fieldwork, and she's an amazing, very progressive, anti-Zionist Jewish Israeli who lives in Berlin now. She's been living in Berlin for years and very progressive, like so many Israelis in Berlin who are young and progressive, and many of them are queer. And she wrote this amazing book called A Queer Way Out, where she actually looks specifically at queer Israelis who are progressive, many of whom are progressive, who then moved to Berlin and established new lives in Germany, which is totally fascinating. So we met a lot of those folks while we were in the field. Also, there are, you know, obviously Palestinians in Germany who identify as LGBTQ or feminist and queer allies. but also there are Germans who identify in this manner as well. What's very particular about Berlin is, given this special relationship that Germany has with Israel, what we see globally on the progressive left, which is solidarity with Palestine, the way that it's so salient, it's common sense, it's been integrated into all axes of struggle. Germany is a case in which you have people across the political spectrum, right, center, as well as left. There are plenty of people on the left who are what we would call progressive, except for Palestine, you know, so they get it on all human rights issues, but on the question of Palestine, they fear or they may be hostile to any kind of expression of solidarity with the Palestinian human rights movement. And so it is disheartening to see that even within the mainstream LGBTQ spaces and circles in Berlin in the present, there could be this racism towards Palestinians that manifests in sometimes these violent ways. And this is very, very, very concerning. But I do think, and we allude to this very briefly, that as Berlin is more and more cosmopolitan, and as people go to Berlin from across the world, across the Middle East, from across Europe, queer folks are immigrating to the country. Queer folks are visiting the country from all over the world. And they're bringing with them these critiques of homonationalism and of pinkwashing. And more LGBTQ Germans in Berlin are having to grapple with these questions and are being confronted with these questions. It's creating a kind of cognitive dissonance. But more and more of them are actually realizing that to embrace a truly feminist, queer, progressive politics, Palestine solidarity is a major pillar of that.
So if I can add to this that, yes, as Saed said, we are interested in these issues and have various research projects on gender and sexuality, but it was not our main focus when we wrote this book. There is this irony of Berlin being one of those centers of progressive movements in the context of queer lives. When we think of Magnus Hirschfeld, for example, and the period of the Weimar Republic. And then on the other extreme, we have the era of the Holocaust, when not only Jews, but also queer populations, homosexuals, specifically homosexual men, were murdered. And today, jumping a few decades ahead again, Berlin is one of the queer centers in the world. There is a very vibrant queer and LGBTQ plus community, something that we personally enjoyed very much. But coming back to our book, there is actually a passage in Saed's postscript that I would like to refer to, which each time I read it, it makes me shiver or have alarms, tears in my eyes, which is that he felt this contradiction that on the one hand, he feels this his body and him as a person, him as a queer person, being fully embraced in Berlin like nowhere else in the world, even more so than San Francisco or Provincetown or other major queer centers. And the irony is that he does not feel embraced. He feels actually rejected and censored as a Palestinian. So it's this very non-intuitive situation where we have all of these extremes.
I'm not even going to comment on this. This is also another good moment to call for people to actually read the book, and it's full of these intimate accounts, which are also full of contradictions. And yeah, the book doesn't really give a clear-cut answer to anything, but showing actually how all these lies, including yours, but also your interlocutors, are filled with these intimate contradictions. And what were some of the surprising things that came out of your interview, some of the things that you didn't expect, or some of the things that shocked you?
Well, for me, frankly, it's having had a life in Germany, growing up in Germany, and being very familiar with the Jewish German community, but also being very familiar with Israeli society, as in I became an Israeli citizen at the age of 21 and have lived in Israel for 10 years and worked in Israel for over three decades now. And so I'm very much connected to both the German Jewish community and the Israeli society. And so what really shocked me is the level of reluctance to criticize Israeli politics among the German Jewish community, and this contradiction between supporting everything that has to do with Israel, blindly so, because very few German Jews are actually well informed about Israeli politics, but there is this blind support of the government and the country, and also this conflation of if you criticize Israeli politics, you're automatically anti-Semitic. And then there is this Israeli community that lives in Berlin, but they're completely separate. Rather than showing interest and embracing what the Jewish community in Germany claims to love, there is absolutely or very, very, very little overlap between these two communities, the German Jewish community and the Israeli community. So this is something that was very strange for me to discover.
And I would like to ask.
And maybe also the fact that German Jews very much join the view of many Germans who think that if you criticize Israeli politics, you're an anti-Semite, that this is something German Jews and Germans have in common. And it really puts the Israeli community that has chosen to live in Berlin temporarily or long-term into a very strange place. And I obviously identified more with this lefty Israeli community who feels shocked when I'm being, I mean, it never happened to me, but I always tell Saed, if this will ever happen to me, that someone will refer to me as an anti-Semite because I criticize Israeli politics, I don't know what I will do, but I feel like I'm totally committed to my Jewish roots, to my Jewish history, to everything that relates to Judaism, really. I mean, it's my field of study, and I'm a very committed and informed Jew.
I was surprised by many things. So one disheartening phenomenon that really disheartened me was the level of censorship in Germany, and including in Berlin, and the institutionalization of censorship of Palestinian and pro-Palestinian voices. I was just astonished by the extent to which there are organized, powerful efforts to try to just completely eradicate these voices from the public sphere and in public spaces in Berlin. This took me by surprise, given the democratic and cosmopolitan context that you would otherwise expect in such a city. So that really was disheartening. At the same time, I was really moved and deeply touched by the points of intersection that Berlin makes possible between Israelis and Palestinians in the city. And that's why Kati and I devoted a whole chapter called Points of Intersection, where we actually provide examples of those spaces. It just truly warmed my heart, and it made me realize that there are spaces that Berlin makes possible in a kind of post-Zionist context that we could envision one day for Israel-Palestine. There are spaces that are not possible in Israel-Palestine, given the apartheid, given the military occupation, given the system of oppression that exists back home, but that is actually, you know, you can not only imagine it in Berlin, but actualize it in Berlin. And so, ironically, Berlin sort of gave me a vision for what the future of Israel-Palestine could look like one day when the system of oppression comes to an end.
And yeah, before we close, I also wanted to ask you about your disciplinary differences and the collaborative writing process. Kati, you're an archaeologist, and Said, you're a sociocultural anthropologist. How did you bridge these differences? And more than that, maybe also, how was it writing together? What was the process like? And I'd like to also add, it's such a beautifully written book that makes a very complex issue very accessible to general publics, I would say. So how did you come to that point in your writing?
So first of all, I think it was our friendship that was a good basis. And I think also our political views were not only compatible, but I would say identical. We never had any political disagreement. I think sometimes one or the other had a more complex understanding of certain issues, and we learned a lot from each other throughout the process. I definitely learned anthropological methods and methods of how to interview individuals from Saed, and he was a great teacher. I really appreciated his patience. I would hope that I contributed in other dimensions. I worked more on the historical tools that contextualize many of the encounters and situations that we described. And I think we also complemented each other linguistically. Most of the interviews were conducted in English. A lot of the literature is written in English, but there were some interviews where I benefited and the interviewees benefited from the fact that I could talk to them either in German or in Hebrew, and other interviewees who could speak in Arabic with Saed. And the same is true for the literature. Some of the literature that we reference and that we read was in Hebrew or in Arabic or German. And so we divided up some of these tasks. It was actually very natural. Maybe the one point where there was some tension is that we have very different working habits. And this was maybe the only point where there was some conflict or tension along the way, but ultimately with some distance, we actually realized that even in this regard, we very much benefited from each other. Saed has this style of writing very quickly a first draft and just brainstorming and putting it all on paper. And I will, it will take me an eternity to finish a sentence, and I will not go to the second sentence unless the first sentence is perfect. And so I at times felt really, really pushed to, but in the end, it was very good because we produced our first draft, book draft, very, very quickly. And then we went over it numerous times and polished the text. And it was so successful that we ended up working together on several other projects. In the meantime, we finished co-editing a volume on queer Palestinian and Israeli film, and we have written a bunch of articles. So we work really well together.
I really agree with everything Kati said, and I appreciate everything you just said, Kati. Thank you. And Armanj, thank you also for your very kind words and for your very compelling question. I'll just add that it as a sociocultural anthropologist, I realize that so much of our work is so lonely, you know, and so individualistic, and it's in some ways imperialist. We sort of claim our territory, and then we leave our stamp and our mark behind, you know, etc. But embracing this model of co-authorship and collaboration with another scholar was incredibly rewarding and enriching and fulfilling. Obviously, having a shared friendship, as Kati mentioned, as well as shared ideological commitments and political and ethical commitments, helped facilitate that. But the disciplinary question that you raised is also amazing, because it made me appreciate archaeology and visual culture and the work that Kati does, although some of it is, you know, is in an ancient context or a very, very different historical context. I saw that the sensibility that Kati brings as an archaeologist was invaluable to actually carrying out our ethnography, because what we did was that we went to film festivals and we visited people's homes and met in cafes and we traversed the entire city and the entire city's landscape. We mapped out neighborhoods, we mapped out demographics. It was truly exciting, such an adventure to explore the city in this way, but to do so with an archaeologist who's such a perfectionist and committed to not leaving a single stone unturned and wants to understand the full landscape on a macro level and a micro level. Kati has this amazing, comprehensive bird's eye view, but then is able to dig very, very, very deeply in each particular, very local and intimate context. I thought that enriched our ethnography so much more, and it made it so much more exciting, and as a result, comprehensive. I really stand behind our book and the power of our book and the comprehensive nature of our book. I think we were really able to capture so much in just one manuscript. So I'm so grateful for all of our work together, and thank you for having us on your podcast. It really was an honor.
Oh, I mean, on that note, thank you both so much for joining us. And as we are closing, I'd like to repeat, we had a wonderful opportunity to talk to Katharina Galore and Saed Atchan on their book, The Moral Triangle, Germans, Israelis, Palestinians, that was published in 2020 by Duke University Press. And this is the Anthropology Channel of the New Books Network. And I'm your host, Armand Gildas, looking forward to the next episode.